Psalm 46. Let us hear the word of our God. To the choirmaster of the sons of Korah, according to Alamoth, a song. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. Selah. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Selah. In early April 1521, as he travelled to the city of Worms in Germany, Martin Luther penned his famous hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. It was based on this psalm. It was his favourite psalm. On the 8th of March 1750, John Wesley stood in Hyde Park, London, and preached his text that day, Psalm 46. On the 11th of September 2011, Barack Obama stood at Ground Zero in New York and read from the Bible his text, Psalm 46. What these occasions have in common is not just Psalm 46, but the backdrop against which it was read or sung. Martin Luther wrote his version of Psalm 46 as he traveled to Worms because he was in great trouble. He had been summoned by the Roman Catholic Church to appear before Emperor King Charles V to recant his teachings on the Christian gospel. Not only was his ministry in danger, but so also was his life. John Wesley preached on Psalm 46 in Hyde Park on the 8th of March 1750 because London had just experienced two earthquakes in a matter of 4 weeks. On the 11th of September 2011, Barack Obama read Psalm 46 because 10 years earlier, terrorists had flown aeroplanes into the Twin Towers in New York City. In each of these occasions, Psalm 46 was read or sung against the backdrop of trouble and danger, of threat and destruction. There were threats from the enemies of the gospel against Luther. There were tremors from the earthquake in London. There were terrorists flying planes into buildings in New York. And in each case, the people heard these arresting words. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The word trouble in verse 1 is actually in the plural. And since we're given no historical context in the title of the psalm, the word is left unspecified. Luther captures all the possible options when he says, these troubles concern any attack on Christ's church or his word from fanatical spirits, from the gates of hell, from the devil, from assaults from the world, the flesh, and sin. Well, that pretty much covers everything, doesn't it? The world, the flesh, the devil, they cause us trouble all the time in 1,000 different ways. And so this is a psalm for all our troubles, whatever they may be. But whatever they may be, they are primarily experienced together. Did you notice that in the psalm? This is not a personal psalm like Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. Or Psalm 121, I lift up my eyes to the hills, from where does my help come from? Or Psalm 139, search me, O God, and know my heart. No, this is a corporate psalm. God is our refuge. He is our fortress. The Lord of hosts is with us. So we should respect the corporate nature of the psalm. The troubles that we experience in our individual lives are experienced together. There's no such thing as an individual Christian. That's like seeing a thumb walking down the street. The thumb is part of the hand, and the hand is part of the arm, and the arm is part of the body. And that's like us Christians. We're all connected together so that when one of us is in trouble, all of us are in trouble. When one of us is mourning, all of us are mourning. Just think of Martin Luther on his way to meet the emperor who wanted to excommunicate him and to execute him. It wasn't just Luther as an individual who was under threat. It was Christ's church. And his hymn reflects that. There's corporate language throughout it. Because Luther understood that his own individual battle for the gospel was the church's battle. So whatever troubles you face this morning as an individual, they are our troubles as a church. We are all in it together. And as we experience troubles in this life, this psalm says three things to us. Number one, God is our very present help when our world is falling apart. God is our very present help when our world is falling apart. Verses 1 to 3. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The phrase very present help, or ever present help, or ever proven help, carries a sense of readiness, of sufficiency. God is ready to help, and he is sufficient to help. He is more ready to help than our troubles are ready to trouble us. He's more capable of helping us than our troubles are of troubling us. That's the sense here, which is why he is a help above all other helps. Sure, we can try and help ourselves a bit in the midst of our own troubles. Sure, other people can come alongside and help us in our troubles. But God is the best help because he is the very present help. And that is why, verse 2, we should not fear anything. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. And to hit the point home, the psalm speaks in the extreme. It gives us the worst case scenario. One of the things that we joke about in our home amongst my brothers is our father, who we have affectionately nicknamed Worst Case Scenario Wes. Worst Case Scenario Wes. Why? Because he has covered all eventual possibilities for anything going wrong in the house. If there's a possible fire, he's got something ready. If you lose your keys or forget your keys or lock yourselves out of the house, there are secret places in the garden to find the keys. He is Worst Case Scenario Wes. And this psalm is a worst case scenario psalm. The sons of Korah paint the worst case scenario. Because look what's slipping and moving and trembling. Though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. The earth and the mountains are the two most immovable things in the whole of the created universe. In Psalm 104, we read of God setting the earth on its foundations. The earth doesn't slip. It is set. We read of mountains rising above the waters. They're not moved into the heart of the sea. We read of the sea being appointed its place and being given its boundary. The sea doesn't rise and cause mountains to tremble. The sea licks the feet of mountains as it obeys the command of God, "Thus far you shall go and no further." But do you see how extreme this language is? How hypothetical it is? How worst case scenario it is? It's a picture of the most violent disruption in the world on a cataclysmic scale. It's a picture of our whole world falling apart. Except for one thing. God. The only thing in the world that doesn't quake or move or tremble when the world is falling apart is God. When the earth quakes, God doesn't quake. When the mountains are moved, God isn't moved. When the seas roar and foam and cause mountains to tremble, God doesn't tremble. You can't move God with a bomb. You can't fly an aeroplane into him and topple him. He's unshakable. He's immovable. He isn't scared by anything. He's never had an anxious thought in his life. It's why he is our refuge and strength, a very present help, because he can't be shaken. He can't be moved. He can't be scared. It's why he is our refuge. Because when the world is falling apart, what refuge is there except the God who is not falling apart? Now, boys and girls, there's a famous photo that I think captures this reality of God, that he is immovable, that he is safe in the midst of chaos. It's a photo of a French lighthouse. It's located in the Celtic Sea in the North Atlantic Ocean. I have a photo here, and you won't be able to see it clearly, but I want to show you a bit of it so that you might actually come up and see it afterwards. Some of your parents might know this photo. It's a photo of a lighthouse in a raging sea, and it's a famous photo taken in 1989 by a French cameraman in a helicopter in the midst of this storm. And it's famous not because it's a photo of a lighthouse in a storm. There are lots of photos of lighthouses in storms. But boys and girls, it's famous for this one reason. That there is a man standing at the door of this lighthouse. Come and see me afterwards and I'll show you this photo. As the waves are crashing around this lighthouse, as the waves are enveloping it, there's a man standing outside at the door looking up at the cameraman in the helicopter, and he's got his hand in his pocket. He's just standing there watching him. He's totally relaxed. He's totally calm. Why? Because in the midst of the storm, he is in a place of refuge which he knows is immovable. It's unshakable. Even though the waves are crashing around him, he can't be touched because he's in the lighthouse. And that is a picture of God here. He is our lighthouse in the midst of the storms of life. That is the first thing that this psalm says to us this morning. God is our very present help when our world is falling apart. Second, God is our very present help when our enemies are raging about. God is our very present help when our enemies are raging about. Verses 4 to 7. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her. When the morning dawns, the nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Do you notice the dramatic change from the noise and chaos of mountains crashing into the sea to a quiet, tranquil river flowing into a city. We're supposed to see the contrast because water is still in view. The last section ended with waters roaring and foaming and swelling. And then here is water trickling into a city. In verse 3, the waters bring trembling. In verse 4, they bring gladness. It's debatable what exactly the river symbolizes here, but I think God's grace and presence administered by His Spirit is a good guess. Here is a city that symbolizes the people of God, and it is irrigated by God's grace and presence. And that makes best sense because the river of the city leads to the resident of the city. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. There's a great advert for Northern Ireland at the moment, released by the Northern Ireland Tourist Board. The voiceover is Liam Neeson, the actor, and he says, "Places are made and measured by the people who live there. Places are made by people. Discover the people, discover the place, discover Northern Ireland." I'm sure you'll agree, it's why Northern Ireland's the best place on earth. Because of the people, right? Well, this city is made and measured by the person who lives there. God Most High. It's the person who makes the place. And how does God make this place? He makes it safe. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. The city is immovable because God is immovable. And the verb move here links us back to the mountains in verse 2 that were being moved into the sea. We're supposed to see the contrast. Mountains moving into the heart of the sea and a city on a hill, on a mountain, unmoved. Why? Because God is in the midst of her. And it's not moved because God comes to rescue her when she's under attack. Verse 5, God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when the morning dawns. During a war in the ancient Near East, or even today, the most vulnerable time for an army was when the men were just waking up, just as the morning was dawning. They were unprepared to fight. It was the most vulnerable time. And that's the point. God helps us at the most vulnerable time. That's why He's the best help. He helps just when we need Him to help. The point is, we need it because outside there is a raging enemy, verse 6. The nations rage. Again, the word rage links back to verse 3 where it's the same word for roar. The nations are like the seas, roaring and foaming at the city of God on a mountain. They are like those waves, boys and girls, crashing against the lighthouse. That is what the nations are like, battering God's people. But no sooner have they started to batter and to thrash and to rage than their kingdoms begin to totter. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. And they totter and fall because God utters His voice. He steps into the fray and thunders at our enemies. It's a picture of strength and terror. Because not only do kingdoms totter, but the earth melts. Or perhaps better, wavers. Which links back to verse 2. The earth gives way. Here the earth is wavering. It's a different word, but it's the same idea. And this is why God is our very present help when our enemies are raging about us. Because He just needs to speak a word and kingdoms totter and the earth wavers. It's like that beautiful line in Martin Luther's hymn that we have sung this morning, speaking not of nations but of the devil. One little word shall fell him. God just needs to open his mouth and the kingdoms of this world totter. And it's that picture of a terrifying warrior present with us, fighting for us, thundering at our enemies, that is captured in verse 7. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. The word host here means army or armies. It's a military title for God. The Lord of armies is with us. The God who lives in the city is a military general. He's a warrior. It's why we're safe. It's why he comes at the breaking of the dawn to rescue us. And we're safe because he is our fortress. Now, this word fortress is different to the word refuge in verse 1. And it refers to a high tower, an inaccessible tower. Boys and girls, I've told you about the lighthouse, the picture of the lighthouse. I've got another picture for you. This is a tower in Ireland, just outside Dublin, in a place called Glendalough. I don't know if you can see it there. This is a tall stone tower. This tower is 1,000 years old. It's older than the Round Church in Cambridge. What's fascinating about this tower is that it's 30 meters high. It was used as a lookout point. It was used as a bell tower. It was used to guide pilgrims. But it was used as a place of safety. And here's why, boys and girls, it's an amazing picture of safety. Because when you walk around this tower, and Jackie and I visited this years ago, you walk around it, there's no door into it. The only way you can get into this tower is by climbing up a ladder and getting in a little door that's 3.5 meters above the ground, and then you pull the ladder in and shut the door. It means that when the enemy was coming and people were in the tower, they couldn't get into the tower. There's no way in. It's impenetrable, impregnable, inaccessible. There's three more big words. Inaccessible. This big, high tower. And that's the picture of God as our fortress. He is our high tower from which the enemy cannot get to us. So we've seen that God is our very present help when our world is falling apart. He's like the lighthouse in the storm. He's our very present help when our enemies are raging about. He's like the high tower in the forest in Ireland. But the big question is, how do we know these things are true? So far, the psalm has just said that they're true, but where's the evidence? How do we know that the God who helped us yesterday will be there for us tomorrow? How do we know as a church that the God who helped us 17 years ago find a minister will help us find the next minister? How do we know that the victories that God's church has experienced in different parts of the world this past year will not be overthrown in future years? I mean, just think of Martin Luther. His gospel preaching and Bible translation turned Europe upside down. But now look at Europe. The kingdoms of Europe were toppled for a time. But now they've risen again, and it feels like the church is toppling under the pressure of secularism and Islam. Is God still our very present help? Or is it just temporary? Is it transitory? Does his help last? Which brings us to the final section of this psalm. We've seen that God is our very present help when our world is falling apart. He's our very present help when our enemies are raging about. And third, God will be our very present help forever. Verses 8 to 11. We can see this in two ways. God will be our very present help forever because, verses 8 and 9, he has fought a war to end all wars. He's fought a war to end all wars. And second, verse 10, because he will be exalted among the very people and in the very places that troubled us. Let's take a look at both of those. God is our very will be our very present help forever because he has fought a war to end all wars. Notice the invitation in verse 8. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations on the earth. The question is, who is being invited here to come and behold? It may be God's people, but I think more likely it's the world. God invites the world to come and see his works. And what is the work of God in the world? It is war. God has made desolations on the earth. He makes wars to cease. He breaks the bow, the enemy's long-distance weapon. He shatters the spear, the enemy's close combat weapon. He burns the chariots, the enemy's ultimate weapon. In other words, God doesn't use diplomacy. He doesn't sit at the peace table, at the world summit, and negotiate peace. He goes to war. This is Genesis 3:15, played out on the stage of world history. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. God is the one who goes to war. But it's not war for the sake of war. It's war for the sake of peace. Do you see that in verse 9? He makes wars to cease to the end of the world. Peace is the outcome. War is the process. I'm sure we've all heard of Leo Tolstoy's famous book, War and Peace. Well, here's an even more epic war and peace story. It's the story of God's war to bring peace on earth. And what does God do? He completely and utterly removes the enemy's arsenal for war. He smashes their spears. He breaks their bows. He burns their chariots. There is no capability for war again. But the question is, which war are we talking about here? Is it when Pharaoh and his men were drowned in the Red Sea as the morning dawned? Same words as verse 5. Egypt never really troubled Israel again. Is this when King Sennacherib of Assyria woke up one morning to find 185,000 of his men slain by the angel of the Lord as they besieged Jerusalem? They woke up in the morning to find it. Assyria never bothered Judah again. But the problem with locating these wars that God has made in those two examples is that those wars never brought all war to an end. Babylon came after Assyria and made war with Israel. So is verse 9 just a wishful hope, a bit of wishful thinking by the sons of Korah at their time in history? You know, a bit like H.G. Wells' catchphrase of the First World War, the war to end all war. It was a mantra of faith during the First World War, but it became a saying of cynicism after the war. A bit like George W. Bush's war on terror. Just think of all the ongoing problems in Iraq and Afghanistan, with ISIS in Syria, with the Paris attacks, with the Belgium bombings. It wasn't the war on terror to end terror. So which war is God talking about here? Well, I think the answer is in that little word, behold, in verse 8. Come and behold the works of the Lord. Because it's not the normal word for seeing. Rather, it's the word used for visions in the Old Testament. It's the word used by prophets for seeing something in the future. Come and envisage. Come and have a vision of a war that ends all wars. The war when God himself was with his people, fighting for his people against their arch enemy. Because isn't that what this psalm is all about? God being with us. The Lord of hosts is with us. God fighting for us. He is the Lord of armies. And why is he with us, fighting for us? In order to save us, in order to be our fortress, God is with his people, fighting for his people in order to save his people from a world falling apart and from their enemy raging about. And where does that find fulfillment? In the person of Jesus Christ, our Emmanuel, God with us, our warrior, the one who fought the world, the flesh, and the devil on our behalf. And in that war, Jesus brought all war to an end. Sin was defeated when he died for sin's penalty and to sin's power. Death was defeated when he died and rose again. The devil was defeated when he resisted him in the wilderness and finally on the cross. Jesus' whole life was one long war. The long war against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And in that war, he brought all other wars to an end. He began the reign of peace on earth. Through his death and resurrection and ascension, he won the final victory over everything that troubles his people. And he became the Prince of Peace. And having become the Prince of Peace, he now speaks verse 10. This is the second reason why God will be our very present help forever. He has fought a war to end all wars. And secondly, because he will be exalted among the very people and the very places that troubled us. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The nations in the earth, so far in the psalm, have posed the threat to God's people. The world was giving way and shaking the mountains. The nations were raging at the church. But now look what is going to happen. God will be exalted among the nations and in the earth. And so these words, be still and know that I am God, they're not primarily spoken to the church, they are spoken to the world. God speaks to all of the things that bang on our lives, the sin, the flesh, the devil, death, anything that batters on our lives. And God says, stop it. I have won a war to end all wars. Stop it. And know that I am God. From east to west, from north to south, the peace of my Son will rule this world. So why resist the inevitable? The Prince of Peace has won the war. That is what verse 10 is really saying to us. And it is therefore a comfort to us as Christians, because it is reminding us of the victory that God has won and that he will win among the nations and in the earth. It is said that Martin Luther, when he was feeling depressed and discouraged in life, would say to his friend Philip Melanchthon, come, Philip, let us sing the 46th Psalm. Why? And then he said, and let them do their worst. Let us sing the 46th Psalm and let them do their worst. Why? Because he knew that God was his very present help when his world was falling apart, when his enemies were raging about. He knew that God would be his very present help forever, because he won a war to end all wars, and because he would be glorified among the very people and in the very world that was troubling him.